Shabbat Pikudei 5765. Here's a story that goes like this. Three men gather to brag about the money, amount of money they give to their different houses of worship. The first states, "Every week I get my paycheck and cash it. Then I draw a circle and throw all the money into the air. The money that falls in the circle is my pledge for that week." The next fellow, seeking to best his friend, says, "Each week I too draw a circle, and I throw all the money I earned into the air. The money that falls outside of the circle is that which I offer for my pledge." The third fellow, the devil's advocate in our story, says, "I too draw my circle each week. I throw my earnings into the air and say, 'God, keep what you want and return the rest.'" God and money are the source of many jokes in religious life. Perhaps this is due to the tensions these cause in the life of the community. Let's take a poll. How many of you receive at least 20 pieces of mail, each requesting money? 50? More than 50 in a given year? I remember a former congregant who told me he received 150 requests every year, though he also told me his mistake. As a young man, he had made a habit to send something in response to any request, even if it was only $5. And the result today is his mailbox is always full. We might wonder if Jewish texts speak to the issue of money in the community. In the earliest of rabbinic writings, we find a lesson that hints that even the Torah itself worries about the financial well-being of the Jewish community. In Mishnah Yoma 4, chapter 4, Mishnah 3, we are told that the high priest offered incense in one of two special pans. Throughout the year, these pans were made of silver, but on Yom Kippur, the pan was made of gold. The question was, well, why not use gold pans every day? The answer lies in the fact that the gold pans, while costing the same to make, were out much more quickly than the silver pans, and cost quite a bit more in terms of the material used. Thus, to have used gold pans every day would have created an unnecessary expense for Israel. Paying attention to the cost of the pans was the Mishnah's way of expressing concern for the resources of the people of Israel. This passage teaches us that Torah is connected to the financial health of the Jewish community. Now, have you ever seen this cartoon? Moses stands on Mount Sinai, and he has a copy of the Ten Commandments in his hands. But he's looking up, and he asks God, "Well, what about funding?" I share both the passage from the Mishnah and the cartoon with you to introduce the concept in Judaism that there is a halakha about money. As you may assume from the Mishnah, it is a positive notion for Israel to have money, even for Israel to be wealthy. But money, in and of itself, is considered only neutral by our sacred texts. Though it was considered a good thing to have, the Talmud notes that there were times when, even for sacred purposes, money was misused. The priests would go into competitions to see who had the best sacrifice, and by the best, it meant the most expensive. Another example comes in the Etrog competition. And again, like the sacrifices, the most expensive etrog was supposedly the best of the crop for that year. Even when it came to religious expression, Judaism knew that money could be used to denigrate the mitzvah into a competition, and this was cautioned against by Jewish law. Even our text this morning gives us a hint that in biblical times there was a way in which money could be tainted by its use, or in this case, its lack of use. Our Torah portion begins with a discussion of the issues surrounding the precious metals used in the construction of the tabernacle. The name of our parsha, Pikudei, literally means an enumeration or accounting. The Torah gives us an accounting of the gold, silver, copper used in the construction of the portable tent. The Haftarah gives us an account of the finishing of Solomon's temple, and also hints at another issue in our parsha. The Haftarah for this week tells us of the special place in which some monies were kept. As Solomon completes the work of the first temple in Jerusalem, and he begins the process of moving the valuables of the kingdom into the divine treasury, among these is an amount of silver and gold that he inherited from his father David. The question arises, why didn't Solomon use these monies in the construction of Solomon's temple? We would think that Solomon would have spared no expense in creating the building that would bear his name as the Temple of Solomon. We're not speaking of a shlach building, but rather we're really talking about the building where Israel would come to offer its sacrifices to Adonai. A midrash gives us an answer. In Samuel chapter 21, verse 1, a famine had struck the kingdom, but David refused to use gold and silver in order to buy food for his kingdom. By doing so, David had tainted the money, for the money should have been used for the care of the people. Rather than spend any of his wealth, David allowed the people to suffer through this national tragedy based on his greed. There is a way in which money loses its moral fitness or appropriateness. That is one reason that the cleansing of money is called money laundering. Another notion concerning the fitness of money comes from Abraham Joshua Heschel. He sought to bring the understanding of kashrut, a different level of consciousness, when it came to money. Many know that in observing the laws of kashrut, it is vital not to eat any blood. In Judaism, blood is the life, and while we may eat of the flesh of an animal, we may not eat that which gave it life. In fact, this is taken to the extreme when making, well, an omelet. Those who observe kashrut will crack one egg at a time into a paper cup and examine it to see if there is any blood marks on the yolk. Rabbi Heschel taught, it is good we can tell the spot of blood on an egg. Could we possibly do as well when it comes to a dollar? Can we seek to apply the same standards of acceptability for the money or products that we consume today and ask that corporate America give us products that are not stained with the blood of human beings? We choose to follow this principle when we choose not to purchase goods from companies that utilize sweatshops and other slave labor, or those that support Middle Eastern countries that oppose Israel. When we get into these discussions about the notion of money and how people are suffering in squalid conditions managed by those who resort to terror, it begs the question, at what cost is the price of human dignity? There has to be a point where the kashrut of a dollar is measured at some level. There is a point, a moment in time, a transgression, where money becomes treif. It becomes unfit for sacred purpose. Treif, as you may or may not know, does not originally mean not kosher. In Hebrew, litrof klafim means to shuffle a deck of cards, specifically referring to the sound that occurs when a deck is separated into two halves and then brought back together with that sound akin to ripping. Treif literally means ripped. Since it was common practice in the ancient world to eat an animal a piece at a time, and take the pieces off the live animal. Well, that's graphic enough and you get the idea. If Judaism strives to teach us a sensitivity with regards to the blood of an animal, when it comes to the shedding of human blood in the process of creating our wealth or our goods, shouldn't we be all the more careful in our choices? We live in an age of globalism, and we have seen fantastic possibilities of technology and creativity, yet are these really something we should really be calling progress? Tom Friedman, author of The Lexus and the Olive Tree, writes that one of the greatest forces against globalism is the amount of humanity and culture it erases from persons and cultures. I would take it a step further. I would say that globalism without a humanitarianism quickly becomes a new form of tyranny. We need, for the sake of our consciousness, for the sake of the humanity that we hold dear, and that humanity of others, to ask for the companies that request our business if they are kosher. For the word kosher holds not only the notion of whether a food may be eaten or not, it is the question of the acceptability of a company to the consumer. If the customer is right, then we need to demand a sense of right business practice and moral conduct that is applied to the things we buy. Can we, who have had ancestors who are worked to death in concentration camps, morally demand anything less of today's companies? And if we don't demand it, if we won't demand it, how are we any better? Jeffrey Seglin, who works for the Markula Center of Applied Ethics at the University of Santa Clara, writes, "There is an evil company in Arkansas, some say. It is a discount store, a very, very big discount store. And it will do just about anything to get bigger. You've seen the headlines. Illegal immigrants mopping its floors. Workers locked inside overnight. A big gender dispute. Discrimination suit. Wages low enough to make other companies' workers go on strike. And we know what it takes, what it does to weaker suppliers and competitors. Crushing the dream of the independent proprietor. An ideal as American as Thomas Jefferson, it is the enemy of all that is good and right in our nation." He continues, "There's another big discount store in Arkansas. Yes, this one couldn't be more different from the first. Founded by a folksy entrepreneur who, with notions of thrift, industry, and a square deal where pure Ben Franklin, this company is not a tyrant, but a servant, passing along the gains of its brilliant distribution system to consumers. Its far-sighted managers have done nothing less than democratize the American dream. Its low prices are spurring productivity and helping win the fight against inflation. It's America's most admired company. Weirdest part is, both of these companies, both the evil one and the great fantastic one, are called Walmart Stores Incorporated. Even in the politics of our land, we find this same schizophrenic view of Walmart. A certain Teresa Hines, who you may know is married to a former candidate for president, came out and condemned the practices of Walmart. She didn't discover that until after she had said what she had said, and she happened to own over $1 million invested in the stock company's stock. Now, $1 million to Teresa Hines might be like having a $20 bill in my pocket, yet it speaks to the problem. we are faced with the hard decisions to either pay for our ethics and morals or not. This is not an easy decision. The devil of it is that with all the difficulties that Walmart has faced during this past year, including disputes with unions, protests of the mom-and-pop stores for being put out of business, illegal immigrants in the stores and sex discrimination lawsuits, the company only went from first to fourth on Fortune's most admired list. First to fourth. Even if it's not true, this is how dulled some have become to the ethics applied to money and finances. For many, it just doesn't matter. As Jews, we need to judge the fitness of our dollars and attach a moral and ethical standard to them. When we give tzedakah, we cause our money to become sacred. It helps to bring righteousness to our world. When it comes to our sacred spaces and places, we need to remember the ability to create sacred space comes from a community sharing a covenant with each other and agreeing to support that holy agreement for a purpose beyond the purely personal. It's at this point when you can say that money might actually be touched by God. We also need to consider the monies that are treif, that literally have some sense of ripped or blood on them, and whether or not human suffering and inhumane conditions are worth our consideration. As Reformed Jews, even our detractors in other movements have named and found our striving for social justice to be in the greatest of Jewish traditions. As Reformed Jews, we constantly speak of informed choice as being the hallmark of a knowledgeable Reformed Jew. I believe it is time to take our individual time to ensure that the things we buy and use are made with some of the greatest of ethical standards. As the sage Hillel asked, if we're only for ourselves, then what are we? Shabbat Shalom.